Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Holiday time is here. To listeners who are back visiting their Tulsa homes, welcome back. Who knows what awaits us this holiday season as we reconnect with our elder loved ones? What happens when our aging relatives start to show signs of slowing down? Maybe it's repeating the same questions. A lack of tidiness where before there was only neatness. Some dings on the car that might indicate worsening vision. It could be difficulty with stairs or walking in general. Or late notices on bills indicating a loss of financial control. My guest today, Todd Whatley, is a certified elder law attorney and a partner with the Oklahoma Elder Law Group. Today we'll learn about signs of slippage and the correspondent arising need to execute arrangements so that there's less confusion and conflict as our loved ones age. We'll also learn what it means to be certified in elder law, a newer subspecialization in the legal field. What to do when your loved ones age and how to avoid calamity is our subject today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Todd Whatley, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you tell us what prompted this concern. So adults coming home for the holidays, seeing their elder parents, and what kinds of things have you heard of these folks finding?
Sure. Typically between Thanksgiving and Christmas is a very slow time in our office because everybody's doing other things. What's interesting though is after the holidays, we'll get phone calls to say, hey, I was just home with my parents and oh my goodness, I did not realize that this was going on or different things were going on that they were very concerned about. So we get busy in January helping folks get documents in place, do things because it is now noted that something's going on.
And so you have this nice two-page document that you share with me, but I thought it was pretty interesting, and we can go over this. So you started by just saying, noticing the mental health of a parent. And of course, here we're really talking about early signs of dementia, which could be Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So what kinds of things should people be on the lookout for?
Well, it's interesting that in America today, kids generally don't live in the same city as their parents. And so the vast majority of their conversations are by phone. The older generation is really good at hiding problems. They don't want to talk about it. And particularly between a husband and a wife, typically between the two of them, they can cover for each other very well. And it's not until you spend time face to face with them that you see, man, mom's really not grasping what I'm talking about. She has asked me the same question four times about the grandkids and where they're going to college or whatever. And many times getting into their home, you see things. And I always talk about my mother-in-law, and I think she's okay with this. She is very neat. You will never walk into her home and see a dirty floor. You will never see dishes in the sink. It is always very neat. And if we sometimes walk in and it was not that way, that would be a huge red flag. Something's going on. And so many times you can't catch that over the phone, but going there to visit and you see, man, things are different. Something's going on. Typically that's dementia. That means something is happening that physically they can't clean their house or, you know, move things or do anything, or mentally they're just not doing it anymore. And that's when, you know, that's why visits over the holidays become such a big deal.
And you had a couple of other categories on here. So physical health, I thought was pretty interesting. And what really struck out at me was reluctance to walk short distances or unsteadiness on their feet. So this doesn't mean obviously that someone has dementia, but it could mean their health is, overall health is failing, mm-hmm. or their physical health is suffering, and it could be concordant with something with cognition as well or not. But can you comment about that?
Sure. A lot of houses built in the 60s and 70s are two-story houses with the master bedroom upstairs. Everything else is downstairs. Once you're there, you can see mom's been sleeping in the recliner, not going upstairs. Maybe that's because she doesn't feel comfortable going up and down the stairs anymore. I encourage people to look at the house because as you physically decline, you don't pick your feet up as well. And anything that could cause a trip is devastating. A cord, a rug. Small rugs are just the bane of our existence, you know, because they will trip over them and get a fractured hip, they go under anesthesia, and they're just not the same anymore. And as you know, as a physician, a fractured hip can sometimes lead to a very devastating outcome. And we need to avoid that, if at all possible, get the cords up, get the rugs up, see if mom and dad are not living in their entire house, and do they need to move? Do they need to downsize into a one-level, smooth-surface house? And many times that determination is not made until you're there and you see what's going on.
And the final domain, too, and important for your field now of law, is finances. And so where a parent, an elder parent, may have been kind of fastidious about their accounts, their checkbook, paying their bills, you point out that you may notice on some of these holiday visits back home between the holidays or for the holidays that you could see overdraft notices, see unpaid bills, seeing if creditors are calling. And this is a reality.
Oh, absolutely. And not just creditors, but scammers. You know, who are they talking to on the phone? You will not know that as a child not living there. They will answer the phone, you know, pretty much any time of day. But as you're there, you'll see that the phone is ringing, they're talking, and it's someone that they're somewhat familiar with, but they're probably giving them money. They are giving them Target cards or whatever. You know, it's just horrendous that I've had clients that have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars to these folks. And it's just devastating because either they're afraid, they literally believe that they will send the sheriff out to their house and arrest them if they do not go buy this Target card and read the number off to it. It's amazing. But be there, listen for the phone calls, see who they're talking to. And I encourage people to be a little bit nosy, go through their bills, wherever they keep their bills, see if there are overdraft notices, you know, see if things are going on. And sometimes just ask mom and dad, how are your finances? Are things okay? Are you paying your bills? Are things okay? And just be a little bit nosy because there could be some very devastating things going on that you're not aware of.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Todd Whatley, who's a partner with the Oklahoma Elder Law Group. He's a certified elder law attorney. And Todd, I wanted to talk for a minute about that. The National Elder Law Foundation provides this accreditation or certification, which is fairly rigorous. So tell us a little bit about why a lawyer might do this and what's involved.
Sure. The American Bar has always been a little reluctant to let attorneys become specialized. Back in the old days, they wanted a lawyer to do everything. Well, kind of like medicine, it's become so complicated in so many different areas that thankfully the American Bar has allowed attorneys to focus and become certified in particular areas of the law. Any lawyer can do any area of law. Back when I first got out of law school, I did divorces, I did bankruptcies, I represented criminals. I hated it, by the way, but I could do it. And so any lawyer can do elder law. You don't have to be certified, but the way to know that an attorney dedicates a large portion of their practice to elder law and to make sure that they've been vetted in the very complicated area of elder law is to make sure that that attorney is a certified elder law attorney. And the National Elder Law Foundation is the organization approved by the ABA, the American Bar Association, to determine who gets to carry that certification. It is difficult. You have to be in practice 5 years, and most of those 5 years need to be doing elder law. You need to prove that you've seen a requisite number of clients in each of those areas, and then there's the test. The test is difficult. It's multiple choice and essay, and the pass rate is typically about 30%. Okay.
Wow, and that's very harsh.
It is harsh because we only want attorneys that have proven that they know what they're doing and can demonstrate that. Only those attorneys get to carry the designation certified elder law attorney.
So with that low pass rate, is it something you can retake?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I did not pass the first time. I thought I was ready, but I was not. And then I really buckled down. And I did elder law for 5 years, but some of the picky areas about discrimination and housing and just the very nitpicky things that I needed to know, I did not know, and that's where I messed up on the test.
So. Well, so let's now talk about mechanisms. So let's say an adult child that is comes home and finds mom or dad is suffering and not doing well, unpaid bills, unkempt yard, some things broken in the home that don't seem to be attended to, perhaps some physical infirmity, mental health maybe runs the gamut. So what are the legal options, or what kinds of mechanisms are there out there for us to kind of care better for our parents? And I mean, we're trying to avoid certainly financial calamity, but of course, healthcare calamity as well. And we think, of course, I think first about the health, and maybe you already talked about the two-floor home and the big space and maybe needing to consolidate or move to maybe an apartment or an assisted living facility or even something with a higher level of care.
Yep.
So there's lots of things, but I guess tell us about maybe what are some of the most common mechanisms. I mean, we think about things like proxies or durable powers of attorney for healthcare, let alone finance.
Absolutely. When you see these problems going on, that is the absolute best time to get your parents to an elder law attorney to do some documents. And what I mean is, if you're on this road, it's probably not going to get better. It's going to get worse. Almost everyone spends some period of time incapacitated. Okay, some period of your life, rarely do you just drop dead or just go to bed and never wake up. You spend some time incapacitated, and if you're incapacitated and you have done no legal documents, the only option is a guardianship. And a guardianship is court, where we take away your rights and we give those rights to someone else. You can no longer vote. You can no longer sign a check. You can no longer do anything, basically. Your rights are truly taken away from you and given to someone else, and a judge decides who that person is. And so if there's any family dynamics that are not good, they will become very explosive in a guardianship. And so to avoid that is very simple, is you do a financial and a healthcare power of attorney. That's where you choose someone, you pick the best person to make financial decisions, you pick the best person to make healthcare decisions, do a document with an attorney that will go through and say, look, we need to give this person this power to be able to do things. And I prefer that it be immediately effective, so that from day one, your son or daughter or friend, whoever that you choose, can make decisions for you. But particularly once you become incapacitated, that's when they can automatically, no court, no judges, no anything, they are automatically empowered to do whatever needs to be done. Now, the issue is, how late can someone sign? And I encourage you, if you go to an attorney, like you go home, see mom and dad are having problems, or particularly if they have gotten a diagnosis of dementia, Alzheimer's, whatever, go to an attorney. And if that attorney says, oh, they have a diagnosis of dementia, they can't sign documents, get a second opinion. Because there is a medical diagnosis and there is a legal prognosis, basically, to say, I think you can sign. And it's difficult, but an attorney has the obligation and the ability to say, yes, you can sign this document, or no, you can't. Most non-elder law attorneys will take the easiest route to say, oh, you've got dementia, we need a guardianship. And that is not the case. A good attorney that will sit down, spend time with the client, work through some questions and issues, most likely will be able to get a client to sign documents so we don't have to go to court.
So let's talk for a second about trusts. So there's this idea of revocable and irrevocable trusts. And how do those apply in any of these instances?
Sure.
And I'm sure there's different scenarios.
Oh, yeah. Well, the issue is that is death and dying. Okay. Powers of attorney are pre-death documents. A power of attorney dies when you die. So the person that you chose as your agent, once you draw your last breath, they can no longer do anything. So then we're into post-death issues. And that's where, if you have done no estate planning, then everything that's in your name is now stuck in your name and has to go through probate, okay? A trust is a legal entity that can own property. So you create it and then transfer all of your assets into the trust. So now the trust continues to live after you die, so therefore nothing goes through probate, okay? When you create a revocable living trust, you're in control of it as the trustee. You are the beneficiary of it. meaning that you benefit from it. At your death, those roles transfer to someone else automatically. So you name a daughter as the trustee of your trust. Once you pass away, she is now the trustee of the trust. She can do what the trust says, distribute the house, the checking, savings, whatever, and it's done. No lawyers, no courts. It's super easy.
So what are the risks of going to probate? I mean, I always hear that, you know, yeah, avoid probate if you can. Are there actual costs or taxation that takes a chunk out of it?
Typically not taxation, because today in 2019, and I think for the foreseeable future, you will only pay taxes at death if you pass more than $11.5 million, okay? So that doesn't affect too many of us.
Most of us, right.
So the problem, though, with probate, again, it's court. It opens up the courthouse doors, and so if there's any family dynamics that stayed pretty under the surface while mom and dad's alive, now that they're gone, it's all going to blow up. And in court, it just goes crazy. And so it is expensive. You'll spend somewhere between 5 and 10% of your estate going through probate. You typically cannot be done in less than 1 year. And so from date of death until everything's taken care of is probably a year later. With a trust, I tell my clients, literally, the kids can sit down the day of the funeral. You're in the ground. They're done before everybody gets on the plane. They can literally sit down at the dining room table and work through this and probably, in most instances, take care of it. That quick, that easy, sitting at your house rather than at the courthouse. So don't go through probate. It's expensive, it is time-consuming, and it is public knowledge.
Yeah, and I mean, what you point out is where there are complicated family dynamics, it's painful. And it's painful for a variety of reasons, I guess, mostly because mom or dad are deceased now, and so it can dredge up all of those either ill feelings or not let you achieve some kind of closure on the grief process, mm-hmm. I suspect.
Yeah, people will be nice while mom and dad's around, but yeah, once they're gone, it's all out war.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Todd Whatley, who is an attorney. He's partner at the Oklahoma Elder Law Group. He's a certified elder law attorney, and we're actually talking about the holidays, really, but about when people who live away from their place of origin and come home and see mom and dad who are aging, come home for the holidays and maybe find that mom and dad aren't in the condition that they were the last time that you saw them, or that they're, you know, maybe not as well compensated as they are on the phone. And so you may find some slippage in health, in physical health, mental health, or even in finances. Todd, I want to ask you about your start. So you are, as we talked about earlier, a certified elder law attorney, and we talked about the qualification that brings and the accreditation. But you, interestingly, I find this very interesting. You started your career as a physical therapist.
I did.
And I guess the stereotype we talked a little bit about is that a lot of physical therapists are athletes themselves, mm-hmm. and I think they're going to, you know, be working with athletes. And that was sort of your experience, but then it kind of evolved. So I guess share with us that story.
Yeah. My mother was a nurse, and so I grew up in, you know, healthcare basically. And when I started looking into it, I thought, man, PT is really cool. You get to work with a lot of different types of clients, and my favorite was the athlete. And so I went through school, did all my internships working with athletes and stuff. I got out of school. I went to work for a hospital with the promise that I would get to work with the local football team. They're like, sure, that's fine. Do it on your own time, but you can. I was like, okay, fine. Well, then Congress changed some rules, Medicare changed their rules, and it's like, Todd, you're doing home health. And I was like, home health? That's old people. And so I went from quarterbacks and pitchers and linemen and running backs, you know, doing all that high level stuff to helping Miss Jones get over her fractured hip and going, you know, doing whatever. And so one of my very early clients was, I sat down with her. She had a fractured hip, I think, and she was now home. And I said, what are your goals? And she said, you know, I miss church and I miss going to the beauty shop. If you could help me do that, I'll be happy. And I thought, seriously, this is a job that I go from quarterbacks and running backs running touchdowns and throwing 8-inning, you know, whatever, to helping Miss Jones get to church. So I did my job, worked with her, got her down. You know, after 2 or 3 weeks, I said, Miss Jones, you know, it's Friday. I think you can do it this weekend. And she said, okay. And so, you know, we had practiced going down like two steps, getting in the car, different things. When I came back on Monday, and this entire time, I will admit, I had a really bad attitude because I miss working with my athletes. And I came back on Monday, sat down. I said, Ms. Jones, did you go to church? Yes. I went to the beauty shop on Saturday, went to church on Sunday. And with tears in her eyes, she said, Todd, you have given, see, I can even do it now still, 30 years later. She said, Todd, you have given me my life back. And I was like, okay, I think I can do this.
Wow, that's a very powerful story.
This is a lot. Sure, I can do this. And so she gave me the momentum to then say, you know, okay, just like I told you before the show, the parents and the athletes and the coaches hated me because I was pulling them out of games, you know, making them do things. I thought, this lady truly loves me because I helped her go to the beauty shop and go to church. So I jumped in full-fledged. I loved it. Got kind of bored, went to law school, and almost the very same story happened as an attorney. I was at a nursing home talking to a group of folks, and this gentleman said, I was given very bad advice. I sold my home. I sold everything, spent everything, so my wife could get the care she needed in a nursing home. And the Medicaid rules allow us to protect tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars for a spouse not in a nursing home. He did not have to sell his house. He did not have to spend everything. But he was told that, and he did it. And that gentleman, you know, gave me the passion to do elder law to say, this does not have to happen. The people do not understand what the laws are. My job is to explain to them, yes, you can keep assets and still get the care that you need for yourself or for a loved one.
Well, that's so interesting because I definitely think that that is a perception out there that in order to put a loved one in a nursing home, it's either out of pocket an enormous amount of money or Medicaid, in which case, you know, we know that Medicare doesn't pay for long-term care. It pays for about 90 days post-hospitalization, and that's the limit.
Yep.
So in order to qualify for Medicaid, usually you have to be poor, and there was this concept of the Medicaid spend down, and it sounds like that's the advice he got. It was he had to basically deplete the assets
everything.
For his wife. So
and
tell
that
us
is not the case.
Yeah, so explain that to us.
Well, there's a whole section of the Medicaid laws called the spousal protection rules. The spouse not in the nursing home, they've got to live. They've got to get up and go and do things. And so they can keep the house. They can keep all household furnishings. They can keep a car and any prepaid burial plan. And they get half of the assets of the checking, savings, any other assets besides the home, household furnishings, and car. They get to keep half of that. Generally, I mean, there's a maximum, which is about $126,000. So if a person goes into the nursing home and they are married and they have, let's say, $200,000 plus a house and car, we can protect $100,000 for the spouse not in the nursing home. The other $100,000 does have to be spent, but we can spend it on the house, the car, the household furnishings, or prepaid burial. There's some very clever things we can do to protect $200,000-$400,000 so that the person not in the nursing home isn't broke, but the other person gets the care that they need.
What happened to that gentleman? I mean, so he wound up essentially making himself destitute. Did he wind up having to be in a nursing home under Medicaid or just?
Well, his wife was, and I kind of lost track of him, but yes, he was destitute, basically renting an apartment with his Social Security while his wife was in a nursing home, and it did not have to be that way.
So do those Medicaid protection laws, is that nationwide? I mean, is that any state? So because I always get confused because Medicaid is state and federal, so there are state regulations and, of course, the federal regulations, but you're talking about it at a federal level, essentially. That's
correct.
Protection. Okay.
Yes.
Now, there's another aspect of your work that's interesting, too, and so many of our listeners are veterans, and so may or may not get VA benefits. So the Veterans Administration, obviously, is the location for health care for people that have served our nation, and then there's this concept of service connectedness. So some veterans are 100% service connected, which means they can get all of their medical care and all of their medications through the VA. Now, then there are levels of service connectedness, you know, all the way down even to 10%, where you get a lot less care through the VA. And that's not what the focus of this conversation is, but this is for elder persons who may or may not be veterans. How does that come into play?
Sure. So any veteran that spent 90 days in active duty. One of those days was during a time of war or conflict, and now is either over 65 or has a disability that requires assistance with his ADLs, activities of daily living. It has nothing to do with your service-connected disability. You could have sat at a desk, thank God, never injured, got out perfectly healthy, but now you can qualify for this benefit. It's commonly known as aid in attendance, but the official name is improved pension. And that's the only requirements, and it is there for the widow of a veteran. If the veteran passes away and they were married at the time of typically his death, and she now needs assistance with ADLs, she can get some money from the VA to help pay for home care, assisted living, or nursing homes.
That is absolutely fascinating. Is that something that's not well known, or do
it
people?
It is not well known at
yeah.
all.
So why is it just that the VA doesn't want to publicize it because they think there will be a rush on claims?
Probably. Congress passed it, I think, back in the 50s. But as Congress does, they did not pass any money to advertise it. So it's there if you ask for it, but just most people do not know. Most veterans are truly, just like you said, they're like, I was not injured. I have no service-connected disability, so therefore I don't get anything. And that is not the truth. There is this benefit for non-service-connected disabilities that now require help. You can get this money.
And then one thing that always comes up, too, are if you were not highly or not even service-connected and getting service through the VA, I mean, and this is, I guess, different veteran benefit altogether, but burial and that kind of thing, is that something that comes up in your practice, too?
Sure. And typically, the VA does a pretty good job of that. You know, they will make sure that you get your burial rights and all of that, and they're pretty good at health care, but it's this benefit, and we don't have time to get into the exact details, but I will tell the listeners, if you thought that you qualified, you called the VA and they ask you what your income was and it was too high, please give us a call, because they mess that up all the time. It is based on your income, but you also get to deduct from your income the out-of-pocket medical expenses. And so if you're in any assisted living facility that costs $3,000 or $4,000, that's going to eat up almost all of your income. You now get this benefit. But if you call the VA saying, my income's $3,000 a month, the biggest benefit you can get is about $2,300. They're like, oh, well, you make more than $2,300, but I spend $4,000 a month on care. My income after that is zero. You should get the $2,300.
Wow. So it is it is pretty complicated.
I mean,
you really do, sadly, probably need a lawyer to help figure
sadly,
it out.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah. Well, my guest today is Todd Whatley. He's a partner at the Oklahoma Elder Law Group, and he's a certified elder law attorney, and we've been talking about what to do if a loved one is starting to become forgetful or infirm, and some of the things that you should think about. Todd, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our shows, you can stream them online anytime just by going to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Happy holidays!